Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
It may be one of the greatest moments in sports history, definitely in football history, and absolutely in professional football history. The Immaculate Reception happened December 23rd, 1972, and we have Rich Schmelter here to talk all about it in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen. We have a great episode here, and it's very appropriate because we are airing and releasing this episode on December 23rd. And guess what that is? It is the 49th anniversary in 2021 of the Immaculate Reception. And we are bringing in an expert on the Oakland Raiders and L.A. Raiders and Las Vegas Raiders, Rich Schmelter. Rich Schmelter, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Thank you, Darren, and I'm looking so forward to getting dirty in that Pigpen with you today.
Yeah, I think we'll be rolling in the mud a little bit here because I think we're coming in two different sides of this most famous play in probably football history.
Right. From Steeler country, it's the Immaculate Reception. From the Raiders' point of view, it's the Immaculate Deception.
Deception. Ah, okay.
That was colorful, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely was.
I told you I'm ready to get dirty.
Yeah, you are not lying there. But, Rich, you've been pretty busy. I mean, we've had you on in the past here on the Pigpen, and we know that you wrote some books, and some of them even on the Raiders. But now, from what you're telling me before we came on air, you have a podcast on the Raiders, too. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about your books on the Raiders and your podcast.
Right. I did an interview on the Raiders for my Raiders book back in February of this past year, and I was asked if I would be interested in doing a podcast on the Raiders' history. So, geez, I almost fell out of my chair. You know, I never dreamt of anything like that. And I was able to put it together. In the first couple episodes, I was pretty darn nervous, you know. And but then I worked it all out, and I'm having the time of my life with it. It's called Flashback. And I couldn't use the word silver and black flashback in print because the Raiders own that. But you can say it. We can say it on there. But if anybody is interested, they would have to go to Flashback. And they range from 15 to 20 minutes, and I talk about a certain topic from the Raiders' glory days, from the 60s through the early 90s.
Okay, now can they find Flashback on any podcast provider? Is there a special website
right,
or anything to go to?
Right. All that they have to do is punch in Raiders, plural, Raiders Fan Radio, and just punch in and just look for the Flashback episodes. There's 19 of them, and I'm ready to do my 20th. So by the time this airs, I should have the 20th episode out.
Oh, okay. Nice. Very good. Well, congratulations on that podcast.
And thank you so much.
And maybe you could tell us a little bit about your books that you have out on the Raiders and football in general.
Right. I have the book that I wrote to commemorate the first 50 years of the Raiders from 1960 through 2010. And it's called The Raiders Encyclopedia, and it covers basically everything. I don't mean to sound like this, but they call it the definitive history of the first 50 years of the Raiders. So I thought that was pretty cool, to be linked to it that way. And
right,
it covers everything, every player, every game, every person that scored a touchdown, Raiderettes, executives, you name it, it's in there for the first 50 years of the Raiders. And that started my encyclopedic work, and I also did one on the first 50 years of the Lakers in Los Angeles, 125 years of USC football, and then the first 60 years of the Dodgers in Los Angeles. Prior to that, I did a book on the Cleveland Browns when the Browns were coming back to town in 1999. That's what started it all. And then I did a book called Chicago Assassin about Machine Gun Jack McGurn, who was the top trigger man for Al Capone during the Prohibition days in Chicago. And each of them is they're like having your children, where, you know, you love them all equally but differently. And that's how I feel, you know, with this. It's like I love them all equally but differently. They were all just a pure joy to work on.
Well, and you have quite a wide array of topics that you're writing about too. So that's pretty interesting too. It's keep you on your toes.
I'm delving into Hollywood history now. I'm working on a few projects on Hollywood history, and I'd like to turn some of them into possibly the podcast also. And I have a championship diary series project going, dealing with different teams that won championships and, you know, the struggles that it took, because it wasn't all lollipops and moonbeams for these teams. You know, they had to go through injuries and personal problems and all. And they're going to be quick hitting books, about 50 to 60, 70 pages. And it's going to cover all, it's a diary. It's just a diary of the seasons. And they're just a lot of fun projects coming up. I'm very excited. I feel like I'm 10 years old again. I just, I love it. The modern technology is absolutely amazing to me.
Yeah, that definitely is. Now, you have to keep us posted on that, anything new you have coming out, and we'll make sure we get it out to our listeners and readers on our websites here. So, yeah, congratulations on that.
Oh, but, thank you, my friend. I appreciate it.
Yeah, but we brought you in for a certain task today, because we want to talk about what NFL Films says this play is both the greatest play of all time in football history and probably the most controversial play of all time. And I think we'll probably get into a little bit of that controversy here with you from a Raiders standpoint. And I'm, apologetic to the Steelers. Not apologetic on this play, but I'm an apologist for the Steelers, a fan. And I think we'll have some interesting talk here on this great play, because it's definitely shaped probably both franchises in a good way.
Oh, before we get into this, I just want to say that to any Steeler fans that are listening, I absolutely respect the Steeler organization. I respect what they did in the 70s. I didn't like them because of what they did to my beloved Raiders, but the Raiders got revenge on them a few times. But when you look back in history through a more mature mind, if you want to say that my mind's mature, my family would probably say different. But through a more mature mind, we'll go with that. They were just an incredible team. So, you know, I have the utmost respect for them. However, you know, I still, you know, bleed silver and black.
Yeah. You know, I'm under the firm opinion, you know, even though I was a kid, just like you were during the 70s games, but those two and probably the Dallas Cowboys, that latter half of the 1970s decade, those were probably the best three teams in football by far. And they all three of them had some great games against each other.
Oh, absolutely. It was an era of bully on every corner, on every street corner. I mean, and the bullies being, you know, every division. You know, you had your Dolphins, you had the Steelers, of course, and the Raiders and the AFC, and then, you know, like you said, Dallas, and then Minnesota in the Central, and then Los Angeles in the West. You know, so, I mean, every year you could pretty much count on it, or any time you wanted to watch a game, you knew it was either going to be one of those six teams that were going to be on TV.
Yeah, just some fantastic football played by all those, and some great rivalries came out, and especially this Raiders and Steelers rivalry, really, boy, it had like 10 years of just great games until, you know, the Steelers sort of went downhill a little bit in the 80s, but the Raiders stayed up, but had some great games in the 70s, so...
Absolutely, absolutely amazing games. And no matter what any fan base says, and I might be speaking, you know, from perspective, and I'm sure that all the, you know, everybody in Steeler country and Raider Nation will say, you know, hell yeah, you know, do this. But I think that's the greatest NFL rivalry of all time. I mean, granted, you have your Cowboys and the Redskins and, you know, many others. But I like to believe that was a bloodbath. I mean, and they just didn't dislike each other on the field. They just disliked each other, period. You know, I mean, and it was just, and it was shown on that field. And, you know, both teams were, they were just nasty teams. That's all I can pretty much say.
Yeah, they both had hard-hitting players. They both had players that were questionably, you know, maybe playing dirty tactics, maybe some dirty pool there, but that's football. They both had
a few deflated balls every now and then. Or
yeah. I mean, it even turned into a lawsuit. We had a Raider suing a Pittsburgh coach over some words in that series.
The criminal element. Yeah, criminal element.
The criminal element, yeah.
From the 75 AFC title game, and that carried on until 76 with George Atkinson and Lynn Swann.
Right,
and, of course,
right.
Chuck Knoll. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, it's all part of that, and it sort of really comes to a height right here in this 1972 game that we're talking about. Hold on a second.
Okay.
Sorry about that. One of my wife or my daughter just came in the door and the dog decided to go nuts.
We're fine. I'm locked away in a room off to the corner of the house, so I should be okay.
And I thought I was too, but the dog's got to be, you know, right on my feet here all the time. Okay, let me start that over again then.
Sure.
So yeah, we had some great things that happened during that 1970s, including all those that we just talked about. But sort of the thing that's really ignited everything with the heat between the Steelers and Raiders probably happened in this 1972 season. But they met before that. You know, the Raiders, of course, came from the old AFL. The Steelers were an NFL team, and the Steelers, Browns, and Colts were the three teams that went from the NFL and flipped over into the AFC to play with the AFL teams. So we had our first meeting. You were talking before we got going here between the Raiders and Steelers. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Right, that game happened in 1970, and the Raiders won that game. And then in 1972, the Steelers won the regular season game. So they went into that playoff game at one each. And this was, you know, the winner take all type thing, best two out of three, if you want to say that. But, you know, it meant a lot more than that. The implications were a lot greater in the playoffs.
Yeah, it's really interesting that beginning the first game of the season, 1972, was the Steelers and the Raiders, and it ended up being a 34-28 game. So there was a lot of points scored in that game. So I think there was some anticipation coming into that playoff game, which was the wild card game. I think they only took three teams from each conference into the playoffs back then.
Right. Well, they took the Cleveland Browns were the wild card team.
Oh, were they? Okay, okay.
Yeah, Pittsburgh won that division. First time they ever won a division in 72. And Cleveland was the wild card team, and they almost knocked off Miami in the first round of the playoffs.
Okay, so these were the two other division winners playing, and then the wild card team played the top seed, which would have been Miami for their end of season that year. Okay, gotcha, okay. So I think they were probably going into this game, there had to be all the hype that there was going to be a lot of offensive firepower, having a 34-28 game, you know, earlier in the season between the two. And
you had a great rookie in Franco Harris, and Terry Bradshaw was just starting to, you know, I wouldn't say blossom, you know, he had a few struggles a few years after that, but he was starting to, you know, come into his own as the leader of that team, you know, as far as on offense. So, oh yeah, and he didn't have the weapons at that time that he had a few years later when he had, you know, Swann and Stallworth. But he had great talent behind him, and of course that defense was just started. That defense was the unit that was really blossoming at that time.
Yeah, I think probably both defenses really came out to play in that playoff game because we get into that game. It was played in Pittsburgh. December 23rd, 1972, and the first half of that game, it was scoreless at halftime.
Right.
I think the Steelers had an opportunity to kick a 31-yard field goal. It was a 4th-and-2 play, and they decided to go for it on 4th-and-2, handed the ball off to Frenchie Fuqua, who was stuffed at the line by Jack Tatum, and a sort of a foreshadowing of a collision that would happen later in the game between those two players.
Right. That was a heck of a secondary called the Soul Patrol with Willie Brown. Well, that was before Skip Thomas got there, but you still had, you know, Atkinson and Tatum and Willie Brown. I mean, that was just an incredible secondary.
Yeah, it's very, very hard hitting. You know, I can.
Yes.
The Raiders really like to hit, and that was the rules back then. The defensive backs, you know, you could pound on the receivers a little bit back in those days. You didn't have the illegal chuck rule, or you know, hitting within the first 5 yards back then. You could hand check and get away with it a little bit more than you can in the modern era of football.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
And that's probably what caused a lot of the problems, is both those defensive secondaries just beat up on the smallest receivers of both the offenses, and caused some problems. Caused, like we said, the Chuck Knoll Atkinson feud that they had in the courts.
Yes.
Who am I thinking for the Steelers?
Lynn Swann,
but. Our defensive back, Mel.
George Atkinson.
Well, George Atkinson. But on the other side, you had, you know, Cliff Branch going against Mel Blount and.
Yes.
This before Donnie Shell, but Mel Blount and. He escapes my mind. But they.
Fred Biletnikoff.
And yes. So we had a lot of clashes downfield between DBs and receivers on both sides. They really let them play then. So. Happened a lot there. So, okay, we're in this game, so it's 0-0 to halftime. The offense for Oakland was really stifled. I think their longest play was like 11 yards in the first half. So they had to do some figuring out some things at half, and they did.
Plus, Daryl LaMonica was ill also. Daryl LaMonica was not himself. So that's why they had to bring Ken Stabler in. That's right.
Yeah, he wasn't even the starter really that season. He was still LaMonica. Yeah, you're right. Okay, I forgot about that. So, I did see his name that first game they played, but LaMonica had all the passing yardage in that 34-28 game. Okay, so they get into there. The Steelers kick a couple field goals, believe in the third quarter, maybe one early in the fourth quarter, 6-0. And then we have Oakland's offense with Stabler comes to life. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that play.
Well, yeah, Snake, I mean, he was, this is the play that I fell absolutely in love as a young kid, fell absolutely in love with Ken Stabler. Even though, you know, they eventually lost that game, he was just so cool. He came out with a little smiley sticker on his helmet and had that long hair hanging out. He was just cool as hell. And he took off on a 30-yard run, and, which was kind of a rarity, you know, for a quarterback. You know, you didn't see stuff like that. And he dropped back to pass, and the Steelers sent a safety blitz on him. And with a tackle coming in at him and coming in hard, he noticed an open field to the outside. It was nothing in front of him. He just tucked that ball and just took off and ran, scored a touchdown, and made it 6-6. Then George Blandick added the extra point. And it was 7-6 with only one minute and 15 seconds to go.
Yeah, that's amazing. That is sort of a reminiscent of Stabler's run in the mud when he played for Alabama back for Bear Bryant.
His
run against, I believe it was an Iron Bowl game against Auburn. He had the run.
Auburn.
Yeah,
yes.
So,
he earned that nickname Snake at Foley High School down in Alabama, because the way he would weave up and down that field, he slithered like a snake. So, I was like, who is this guy? You know, because all you heard was, you know, Mad Bomber, Daryl LaMonica. And all of a sudden, this cool-looking guy comes in and does this, and it's like, I like that guy. And it became an absolute, you know, and I had the pleasure of meeting him back in 1994 and got his autograph on a picture. And he was just as fantastic as I hoped he would be. So, you know, Snake, wherever you are up in heaven, whoever team you're quarterbacking up there, you know, I love you.
Yeah, wow, that's pretty cool. I mean, yeah, we lost him, like many of these players, we're losing him much too young.
Yes.
You know, just, and he was one that was sad. That was probably, what, 4 or 5 years ago he passed?
Yeah, December, actually around this time, back in 2015. And then he got inducted into the Hall of Fame the next year.
Oh, geez, too bad he wasn't there to be able to see him. It was posthumously. So,
I know. I know. I have a feeling he was there, though. You know, you got to believe.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, most definitely. Sure he is. You know, I got the pleasure of attending the Hall of Fame ceremonies this past year. the 2020 on Saturday. They had the 2020 class. They had the 2021 class on Sunday. So I was there for Saturday and up in the press box and watching it. But they had a couple of posthumous inductions along with, you know, the live ones. And it was so solemn to hear, you know, it was celebrating the player, but it was kind of sad and solemn that, you know, they weren't there and they would have like a family member or a teammate, you know, representing them, but it just wasn't the same. And, you know, so it's, I feel for those guys that don't get in and have to wait, you know, like Kenny Stabler did. And then they don't get to have that pleasure standing up on stage and wearing that gold jacket.
Exactly. That's why I'm so great seeing that you were there this year. I was so grateful to see Coach Flores go in. I was a big supporter of Coach Flores going into the Hall of Fame, and to see him be able to go in and to see him there wearing that gold jacket, it was absolutely amazing. I mean, I saw it on television. Unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to go down to the hall, but to see that was great. And I just wish Snake would have had the chance to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a 7-6 ball game. A little, you know, a minute and some change left, and the Steelers get the ball on the kickoff, and they don't really, they sort of get shut down the first three plays. It gets down to it's 4th and 10, and they're
right.
They're at their 30-yard line, I think they were
40-yard line. It was
40-yard line.
They started the drive on their 20, and then Bradshaw threw two passes for a gain of 20 yards, and then his next two completions were knocked down by safety Jack Tatum, ironically. And then he was staring at a 4th and 10 situation with 22 seconds remaining. And that's – I'll let you take it from there.
Well, okay, we know we have – you know, Bradshaw goes back to pass. He sort of – he has a tremendous pressure, you know, coming at him. I believe the players here – I haven't wrote down here who they were.
Tony Klein.
Yes.
Horace Jones. And Otis Sistrunk.
Right. And so they sort of push Bradshaw, who's right-handed, they push him to his right. So he's sort of scrambling around there, sort of a zigzag line, and finally finds his feet and just lets one fly sort of towards the middle of the field, down around the 35, opposite 35-yard line. His intended receiver was Frenchie Fuqua, John Fuqua, number 33.
Yes.
And very close to him is Mr. Tatum once again, who, like you said, just knocked down a couple passes on the plays earlier. And there's a collision between the players. There's the ball gets mixed in there somewhere, and it gets deflected back towards the Steelers' goal line that they're defending. And out of nowhere, most famously, a running back, Franco Harris, who's a rookie that season, somehow grabs the ball. I'm telling you from the Steelers side, and you know, gets a couple key blocks and is down the left sideline into the end zone, and pandemonium hits Pittsburgh. So, why don't you describe what from a Raiders standpoint, what you remember from that?
Okay, it was now Otis Sistrunk almost had him on that. I did do my homework on that too when you sent me the video.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I did my homework on that, and I was looking. And now Phil Villapiano, the one linebacker, he was covering Franco Harris. But when Bradshaw sprinted to the left side, both Franco and Villapiano went to the right. He left Franco alone when Bradshaw threw the ball, and he saw the ball going toward Fuqua and Tatum. And so he just figured, okay, it wasn't going to Harris. And that's when that collision happened. Now at that time, nowadays this play wouldn't even have been, it would have been an incredible play, but there wouldn't have been any controversy because the ball can go off of a teammate and on into another teammate's hands. At that time, the ball could not hit, you know, it could not hit a Steeler. It had to hit a Steeler and then had to hit a Raider and then hit a Steeler again to make the play okay. All right. So, at that collision, that was the thing where they were trying to say that it hit off of Tatum, and it didn't. If you could look at that film and everything, and even years later, Frenchie Fuqua said that he had a bruised bicep from where the ball hit him, where the point hit him in his arm. So, you know, a little bit more is coming out slowly as time goes on about that.
Well, I look at it, and I tried to look. I mean, I was a high school football official for 27 years, so I know how to sort of take myself away from fandom and look at it sort of methodically. All right, and so I said, you know, I'm going to look at this if we would have had a replay back then, and how a replay official may have looked at this. You know, one of the gurus up in New York. And really, if you go to the rules of 1972 for that game, there was probably 3 points of contention on that play that I think Raiders fans are gripe the most about. Now, first of all, is the point that you brought up. Did Tatum touch the ball first or did Fuqua? Secondly, did Harris catch the ball cleanly without it hitting the ground? And the third one was the what we would now call a block in the back. At the time, they would call it a clip. Any block behind, you know, from behind would have been a clip. Was it a clip or was it a block in the side on Phil Vilpiano by John Macon, the Steelers tight end? And I think those are the 3 points of contention on that play that I think the Raiders and, you know, I know Coach Madden was very discerned about at least a few of those.
Yeah, he was a very animated man anyway.
Right.
And, you know, that added fuel to it. But I personally have always focused on that hit. You know, I mean, I believe he did. I believe he did scoop that ball up. You know, I mean, I believe he got it before it hit the ground, barely. But the focus was, I think the focus got away from that and went toward Tatum and Frenchie Fuqua. You know, that was the big concern. And as I said, nowadays, it wouldn't have been even a decision. It would have been, okay, he caught the ball and, you know, it was a great play. And it was a great play. I still think it was probably, you know, throughout the whole history of professional football and all, I think it's still the greatest play, greatest story, rags to riches team, that, you know, that were perennial losers for so long, and all of a sudden they make it to the playoffs finally, and then that play happens, and then also it started the Steelers on a run of a dynasty, and it also started probably, to me, the greatest rivalry in professional football history. Again, you're going to have a lot of fan bases saying that I'm crazy for saying that, but I think Steelers, Raiders, any fans of both those teams, I think that's one common bond that we have, was that was the greatest rivalry of all time.
Oh, most definitely.
So that play was it was the greatest play of all time, even though, you know, it you know, I feel like I'm betraying my silver and black, my silver and black empire.
Well, I mean, we've talked about this YouTube video, and I'm going to put a link to the YouTube video. I have a link to it on the Pigskin Dispatch pages. I'm going to put it on the show notes also. But this is pretty interesting, whoever put this YouTube video together, because they sort of have the coach's tape. It's not an all 22 like we know today, like from an end zone, but it's sort of an all 22 from the sideline coach's box. You can see all the players on the field. It's in black and white, so it's a little bit clearer than the grainy color footage from the television that we so famously see. And it really, if you really watch it and you can, you know, slow it down and stop frames and everything, I did that with that. And, you know, first of all, the first thing that jumped out at me, I never saw that angle before. And because I always said, you know, when it shows, every time it shows on, you see that TV feed with Harris catching the ball, you can never tell because sort of the goalpost is from the end zone blocks where the ball and Harris's hands. So you can't tell if it hits the ground or not. All you know is that he doesn't stop running. He just kept on going and he believes he caught it, you know? And so that was always left a little bit of doubt in my mind, but this black and white, you know, press box view of all 22, it makes no doubt to me, I think, that he caught that ball cleanly, just the way his hands were and everything else. You don't see the ball sort of ripple up. It's all pretty continuous, like he caught it, you know, clean.
Oh, absolutely. And I just want to say, Darren, to all the listeners out there that are listening to this show, Darren did a great thing by putting this together. And I would highly advise anybody, please watch this when he posts this, because it was incredible. I did my homework for him, and I watched it. And I watched it numerous times, and I enjoyed it every single minute, even though, you know, I knew the outcome. But it's just a great tool to have for, you know, for this debate. And I would highly recommend it. Please, folks, check it out.
Well, thank you for the kind words on there. The other thing, okay, now the other thing I could never tell from that color television film was, you know, the old argument, you know, Tatum or Fuqua, who touched that ball first or touched it last or whatever, you know, whatever. With this, it made me take a little bit better look at this in black and white. And I also took the sideline view a little bit more closer up of the color version of TV and it slowed it down. And there's a point, I think I sent you a snapshot photo of it, and I, because of copyright, I can't put this on the website. I wish I could, but I don't want to get in trouble with the NFL.
The NFL, you don't want to pick them off.
Well, they own it. It's their right to display however they want. It's not my right to do anything but talk about it.
Right.
But I sort of tried to slow this down, and there's one frame that I found where the ball is probably a foot over top of Fuqua's head, but it's very close to Tatum. So I think that with the trajectory of that ball after impact, the way it went backwards, I almost have to believe it hit Tatum first off a shoulder pad or something hard. I don't think it hit his helmet, but I think it maybe hit his shoulder pad, and you know, then Fuqua was sort of, you know, right in there a split second later, you know, that they collided. But I think Tatum's full momentum hit that ball, and that's why it went back so far in the air. That's my personal judgment. I'm trying to be, you know, not saying it from a Steelers point of view, being a homer on it, but I really believe that they got that call right. And that's
it's hard for me to argue with someone who you know is very astute like you are, and you were a referee. So, but I excuse me, I still feel that, you know, like I said, that the more that I looked at it, I looked at it from another perspective. Of course, I'm looking through it through silver and black glasses, where you're looking through it through black and gold. So that's the beauty about all this, Darren, is, you know, we could agree to disagree and we can debate all this and everything like that. But at the end of the day, I respect you and hopefully you respect me, you know.
That's why I want you on here, because I want to try to get to the bottom of this and have both sides, you know, be represented here, because this is such an important play and it's so much fun to talk about.
I mean, that's the amazing thing. Like I said, it had so much impact on the Steeler organization and the Raider organization also. And I want to just get into something after we finish this up about what would have happened if the Raiders would have won that game. But that's for, you know, a few seconds after this. But I truly believe that, you know, once he went into the end zone, now Tom Flores was an assistant coach at that time. He was the receivers coach for the Raiders at that time. And he was looking down from the press box and he saw, you know, all this stuff going on. And he was like, okay, you know, why did the referee went over and they're looking at each other like, what the heck is going on? He went to a telephone and he started talking to somebody. Now, they didn't even have instant replay at that time. But by then, all these Steeler fans were rushing out onto the field. And if that was in Oakland, would that have happened? And also, would, you know, you had this town that was just a frenzy about football at that time, because they suffered through year after year since 1933. So, you know, you're looking 39 seasons of just horrific football.
That's their first postseason win. Do you realize that?
Oh yeah, I believe they were in the playoffs. I believe in 19. I think there was a tie.
1947.
47 against the Eagles.
But they lost. The Eagles, they lost that game.
Yes, and. So, I mean, these fans were frenzied, and I believe that the officials, I can't remember the source that I heard this from. I don't know who told me this, whatever, but they heard it somewhere or read it somewhere that the officials were like, if we said that Pittsburgh, you know, that it went against Oakland or that it went in favor of Oakland, they would have never got out of Pittsburgh alive, the officials. So right. It's like, hey, you know what? Touchdown.
Well, I mean, I believe there's probably some truth to that. I mean, he definitely, I believe the official's last name was Smirker. He was kind of a famous, he had some other controversial things happen during his career. He was sort of like the Ed Hockules of his day. You know, he was sort of the spotlight official, but things sort of didn't always go right with him. It was a controversy, but when he officiated. But he did go into the Pirates dugout because it was at Three River Stadium. The Pirates played there during the baseball season. And so he went in there and used the phone reporting. This has been multiple reports from both, you know, Steelers papers, national syndicates, and, you know, Oakland newsmen that he did that. And then he came back out onto the field, from what I understand, and then signaled that it was a touchdown. You know, with pandemonium, people all over the field, they're trying to get him off and everything. So I think there were still there were still a few seconds left on the clock after Harris crossed the goal line, if I remember it correctly.
Yeah, but just a mere few seconds were left.
Right. So they did have to, you know, do the extra point and a kick afterwards, I believe.
Yes.
So, you know, Oakland had a little bit of breath of life. But I think out of those three points of contention, after watching this, that block in the back, you know, Villapiano is still to this day says, you know, he was blocked in the back. Where, you know, at the time it would have been called a clip. It would have been a 15-yard penalty if it was called. And what one thing that they always taught us as officials, and it's hard to see from the angles that you have on this play, even though you have an end zone and you have a sideline, it's, you know, which direction was the offended player? Which direction did Villapiano go? If he's hit in the back, he's going to fall forward. If he's hit from the side, which is legal, you know, from the side above the waist is legal hit, he would go sideways towards his other side. It's hard to tell which way he goes. And he may have, that might be the biggest point of contention in this whole thing. You know, it could have hit, you know, I believe it hit Tatum first. I believe Harris catches it. Could there have been a clip on the play and it gets called back? Absolutely. It could have been a clip.
Oh, yeah, and I forgot who it was, but one of the defensive backs for the Raiders came real close to getting Harris knocking him out of bounds. I believe it's like on the 10-yard line, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's like Jimmy Warren was the defensive back, and Harris
Jimmy Warren, and he came
stiff-armed
number
right
20,
on the
I believe.
Line. Yeah.
I believe number 20. And yeah, he came real close. And back, I don't even think Bradshaw said, did Bradshaw even see that play? Did they knock him down?
I think they did catch him. He was, you know, like we said, he had two or three guys sort of draped all
Cody
around
Sistrunk
him.
Came real close to getting him. And I believe that either he knocked him down. I don't know if he even saw that play happen. But,
yeah. I'm not sure. Peyton Manning on his show Peyton Places in season one a couple years ago had a whole episode on the Immaculate Reception. And they ended up, of course, they couldn't do it at Three Rivers. It's been since destroyed. It's a parking lot now for Heinz Field. But they went out to the Rose Bowl, and they had Frenchy Fuqua, Terry Bradshaw, Franco Harris, and Phil Villapiano, you know, the four major pieces of that play. It had him sit on the sideline. Peyton Manning's talking with them. They tried to hire some actor athletes to suit up as those players and try and reenact it. And, you know, time after time, they could not get the ball to deflect. You know, of course, they're trying to get passes in there. So Peyton Manning had to take the role of Bradshaw and try to fire a pass like Bradshaw would. And those four just had a lot of fun with the whole thing. So it's kind of an interesting way to look at it, too. Hearing from those parties. So if you get a chance to watch that, ESPN Plus has the Peyton's Places season one.
Oh, I definitely will. Cause I mean, I think Walter Peyton, I think, Peyton Manning is I liked Walter Peyton too, but, Peyton Manning was, he cracks me up. I mean, I think he would be like perfect for a sitcom, the lead of a sitcom. I mean, I just think he's great. He was great at football. I think he's a great spokesman for that. And Terry Bradshaw, man, I mean, I just, I didn't like him when he played because, again, the Steelers and Raiders, but, now, I mean, I just think he's great, you know. And Phil Villapiano is probably one of the even at his age in the early 70s, I still think he's one of the most animated people around. I mean, he's somebody you want to just sit and have a drink with and just laugh your butt off, you know.
Yeah. Those two, Fuqua and Villapiano, they were having some fun with each other during the whole thing. So, you know, Villapiano's the whole time saying, you know, Frenchie, we know Tatum touched you. You didn't touch it first. And, you know, So Frenchie's sort of wearing a like a button-down shirt or something, or maybe he's wearing a jersey. He says, hold on a second. He sort of pulls up his jersey. He has a black T-shirt underneath it with the words, I'll never tell. that's all part of the mystery and the mystique of this play. From the goalpost blocking the view of the end zone to, nobody talking about it or just, telling their side of the story and they conflict with, with what the other side says. It's just so interesting and it's such an impactful play. It's a great play to talk about.
To me, it's a great play to talk about. And to me, it's not the equivalent because, you're dealing with something that was horrific, but it's almost like, the grassy knoll in the JFK assassination. How many times was that Zapruder film looked at, step by step, and you're kind of talking about this with football, And again, right. It's apples and oranges. You can't say that it's the same because it's not. It was a horrific time in American history. But that's the beautiful thing where you could escape to sports, okay? And, you can escape all the horrific things that happen and go to sports and you have things like this that are similar in that way of just the studying of it all. And I just think it's great because like I said, I think you're awesome. And we're from two separate sides. And if the Steeler fans are listening or the Raider fans are going to be listening, they're going to be feeling the same way, taking each other's sides. But, I just think it's great because you can just talk about this and who's right and who's wrong,
Right. The debate will go on 100 years from now. They'll still have the same debate.
Oh, yeah.
Heads will be talking about it on spaceships or something. Who knows?
Oh, yeah. We're still talking about things that happened, from the 1930s when Wrong Way Riggles in the Rose Bowl in 1929, he ran the wrong way. They're still
right.
talking about this guy.
Right.
92 years later.
Jeez.
So the called shot by Babe Ruth. Sports is just an incredible, incredible diversion. Incredible diversion, and you can just have wonderful times with sports history, even though that it's over, that it ended and all, but you can just talk about it and never be bored with it. It's just great, and just like the Immaculate Reception, or as I like to say again, the Immaculate Deception. Raider Nation, if you're out there, give me a hell yeah.
let's go a little bit of postscript in this. Okay, so Steelers ended up winning that game. 13-7 was the final on that.
Yeah.
They end up going having Miami, who was undefeated at the time, had to travel to Pittsburgh because of some crazy playoff rule, which you and I still can't figure out.
Right.
Miami came up and definitely beat Pittsburgh the next week and went on to play Washington in the Super Bowl and win that and have their undefeated season. So. That's what happened now. So that was not one of the Super Bowl seasons for the Steelers. That happened a couple years after that when they played in Super Bowl IX, played Minnesota. But so this was a couple years before that. Sort of the young Steelers were youthful and getting their feet wet here a little bit. And so were the Raiders. Raiders were a young team. Like you said, Stabler was just having one of his first starts in that game. And
right.
Monica was the quarterback of choice for the Raiders earlier in the season. So. But very interesting how these they collide and they clashed in more playoff games throughout the 70s, like we talked about, all the way through. They seemed like every year was one of those two vying for the Super Bowl from the AFC side.
Even with Miami. Now, when I was saying earlier that, I'd like to discuss this real quick with the Raiders, I think had the Raiders – again, now I'm talking from a silver and black, dreamland of mine, but – if the Raiders would have won that game, I would assume that, the game probably would have been played in Miami then, I would imagine. I wouldn't even know.
I'm not sure. I think, from what I understand, maybe I'm incorrect on this, but I think it was they alternated, like the one year the number one seed would get the home game, and the next year the challenger to the number one seed the top seed would get the home game. And I think it just happened to fall on – it was the lesser seed had the home game that year. So I think Miami would have maybe gone to Oakland.
So they would have maybe gone to Oakland. And I believe that the Raiders could have bumped them off. Because, I mean, the Dolphins in 72, not that they were, again, don't get me wrong, Miami Nation out there, please don't hate me, but I think if you look at their games, they did not dominate like the Raiders did and the Steelers did, you know, throughout the 70s. They didn't dominate that year. Some of those games they almost lost to. Now, they almost lost to the Cleveland Browns in the playoffs the week before. I think it was 20-14, and Jim Kick had a score late in the game. You know, the Browns were beating them 14-13. So it was like they didn't dominate. They just had an incredible ground game that ate up a lot of time. But they did have a great defense, that no-name defense. So I think that would have been an interesting thing. But also when you look at the Raiders had one of the greatest offensive line, to me, the greatest offensive line of all time. I mean, you had Jim Otto, you had Art Shell, Gene Upshaw. I mean, you know, yeah. I mean, those guys, you know, their busts are probably talking to each other in the Hall of Fame right now.
Yeah, definitely a formidable line. You're right. And they were well coached. I mean,
Yeah. And I truly believe that, to get to the Super Bowl, I mean, you went in up against a Washington team that, you know, they were probably the average age was about 35 on that team. You know, it was like, you know, George Allen's the future is now thing. You know, he was getting all these old timers. And a lot of them played for him for the Rams in the 60s. But if you look the next year in 73, I think it was week two, the Raiders or the Dolphins were going for the all-time record of consecutive wins, and the Raiders knocked them off. It was 12-7, but they had to play them up in Berkeley, California, because the World Series, the Oakland A's were in the World Series there, so the Raiders couldn't play at home, so they had to go to Berkeley, California, to play that game, and they bumped off the Dolphins. Of course, the Dolphins came back and beat them in the AFC Championship game down in Miami. But again, you know, who knows what would have happened? And I still think the Steelers would have still had that dynasty. You know, I still think the Raiders and Steelers rivalry would have still gone on, but maybe not as heated as it turned out to be, thanks to Franco Harris. And I thank you, Mr. Harris. I thank you, Mr. Harris, because you know you created an incredible memory. Even though you know, I don't think it was legit what happened, but you know, in reality and everything like that, he created an incredible rivalry, incredible dynasty, and I tip my hat to him.
Yeah, I mean, think about that. If that play doesn't, you know, something happens that that score doesn't count, or they don't, you know, whatever, and that game ends. It's a 7-6 playoff game with two pretty strong offenses. That is still going to be probably one of the greatest playoff games in NFL history. You know, forget about the immaculate reception. It's still going to be a great game that people probably are going to remember. You know, 7-6 defensive standoff in the 70s. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, yeah.
That's tremendous.
On a cold day on AstroTurf in Pittsburgh, I mean, how much more Americana can you get? You know, probably the blast furnaces were going in Pittsburgh, that area. You know, I mean,
yeah, they were still producing a lot of steel at that time. That's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. It's just totally like that movie, All the Right Moves with Tom Cruise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was a high school kid in Pittsburgh and high school football player. And that's what I think of with that, you know, and it was just absolute Americana. You know, football is America's game, played in a city that was Americana, you know, and it was great. It was great, and like I said, it created so much, and gave back so much to us fans who are still talking about it 49 years later, like it just happened yesterday.
Yeah, that's fantastic. All right, I guess before I let you go here, why don't you give us one more time how people can listen to your podcast on the Raiders and the names of your books and where some people can purchase them at.
Okay, it's easy, just punch in my name. If you do that, or if you should just go to one book, you just go to like Amazon. You know, they're all available on Amazon. The Raiders book is just called The Raiders. If you just punch in The Raiders Encyclopedia, and you'll see it come up. A picture of Snake Stabler is on the cover, which I had nothing to do with that, but I just thought that was really cool that they put him on there. It's called The Raiders Encyclopedia. That'll come up, and you'll see my name on there, Richard J. Schmelter, and then it'll link up all the other books that I've done, whether it's the USC one, the Lakers, Dodgers, and, of course, if you're interested in the gangsters, Chicago Assassin, or if you can even find a copy of the Cleveland Browns one, it's called The Browns Cleveland's Team. So they're all out there.
We'll put some links on our show notes for that and at the bottom of the page on this podcast that we have a accompanying website page on pigskindispatch.com for this Immaculate Reception. Down at the bottom, there will be some Amazon links to get the Rich's books there as well. So, Rich Schmelter, we thank you very much for taking the time to talk about this very famous play and to sharing your opinion on it, and hope to talk to you again real soon.
Darren, I look forward to it. Thank you, my friend. And we didn't get as dirty. I think we got a little dirty, but I think we both came out unscathed on this one.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. It was a lot of fun. Thanks a lot, Rich.
Thank you, Darren. I appreciate it.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, is found right here on the Sports History Network.